Hello, everyone. My name is Walker Yule, and I'm the host of Deeper Dive with Professor Nicholas Dungy. We're going to start the podcast in a moment, but I wanted to take this opportunity to ask for your help. Here at Dungy State University, we're doing everything we can to bring you a nonpartisan analysis of today's current events. But this challenge can come with a steep financial burden, and that's where you come in. If you go to urdsu.com and click on the support tab, you can make a donation and help us bring Dungy State University to people everywhere. Again, that website is urdsu.com. Click on the support tab and donate what you can. If financial support is not something you're able to do right now, you can still help us by getting the word out about DSU. Tell your friends about the podcast. Share our posts on Facebook. Retweet what you can. Just tell as many people you can about DSU. Thanks for your support, and now on to Deeper Dive. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Deeper Dive, where we uncover the deeper philosophical origins and implications of current economic, social, and political events. My name is Walker Yule. I'm here, as always, with Professor Nicholas Dungy. Nick, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Walker. How are you?
Great to see you, as always.
Hi, everyone.
Okay, so gentleman by the name of Tom Perkins.
Yeah, he's in the news lately.
Yeah, he perked your interest.
Yes, he did.
And you wanted to talk about him, so here we are.
We have to talk about him.
Okay.
This is another one of those moments that in some ways is transformational for contemporary American liberal democratic politics. In fact, this is, in my own view, this is as important as the assertion that took place 5 years ago that the banks are too big to fail.
Right.
This is another revelatory moment where you simply have to pay attention to what was said and understand what was said and understand why it's not a laughable moment.
Okay. So give us a brief description.
Yeah.
We're actually going to post a link to the article on our website, urdsu.com.
Yep.
So under the podcast, you'll see a link and you can read the whole article in itself. But give us a quick synopsis. Let's discuss why it's important and some of the background. We'll take a break and then really dive into what it means to today's in today's society.
Right. Well, the first thing to know is, again, look, Tom Perkins is a bit of a lightning rod. He's a sort of a spokesman for the uber rich, the 1%, and he's quite aristocratic in his views and in his sensibilities, and he doesn't hide it. He's not interested in any sort of egalitarianism or things like that, and he can be a rather provocative person. So we need to just put that out there. A lot of times Perkins says things that he says to get attention, to kind of shock people. And, in fact, a month ago, he has become the self-spoken defender of the super rich.
Right.
And recently, the super rich have become tired of the way they've been sort of attacked by the 99%. And so they're pushing back a little bit. And Tom Perkins has become the sort of spokesperson, lightning rod for that. And recently, during a public interview, he said something extraordinary, and he said two things. First, that only taxpayers should be able to vote, and two, that you should have votes according to your wealth. So first, only taxpayers should vote, and if you pay $1 million in taxes, you should have 1 million votes.
Right.
Now, obviously, he said this to be provocative. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he said this to get a reaction. And, of course, the reaction to be expected was a combination of outrage and laughter.
Right.
The outrage because most people believe that this is something like a liberal egalitarian democracy, and they have sort of bought into the mythos of what that means, and so they're outraged. The idea that someone could suggest that you shouldn't vote, you shouldn't be able to vote unless you pay taxes, and you should have as many votes as dollars that you pay taxes.
So there are two reactions, laughter, which we'll get to in a second, and outrage. But they're not outraged at the results. They're not outraged like, wait a minute, he's right. They're outraged that he had the you know what's to say this.
Oh, no.
And they're outraged that he would even profess this, that it would even come out. What a silly idea. How outrageous.
Well, that's the laughter part. I mean, the outrageous part is that it is, on the surface, so contrary to the primary themes of modern liberal egalitarian democracy. right? That someone could raise this in a public forum, in a public interview, in a democratic social and economic and political space is on the surface outrageous.
Right.
And then it was laughed. It was so absurd from a certain point of view that most people laughed it off.
Right.
Now, our theme today is that Perkins is telling you the truth, right? What Perkins had said is actually what is taking place.
Right.
What is taking place right now. The rich do have more votes.
So Perkins pulls the curtain back.
Yeah.
And shows us what's truly going on.
Absolutely.
And he's met with laughter. Because nobody will believe it.
Nobody believes it. He's met with outrage and laughter. And the irony of it is he's telling you the truth.
Right.
This is exactly what is going on. And the theme today is not only is this is in fact what's happening, this is not a conspiracy. This is not Perkins being outrageous. It's not Perkins being aristocratic. It's not Perkins being conspiratorial. What Perkins had said is simply the logical conclusion of one of the core ideas of modern liberal political philosophy and economics that begins in the 1520s with Machiavelli, unfolds through Hobbes and Locke and the forming of the U.S. Constitution and the Founding Fathers.
Okay, I want to get this clear. We'll do the background in a second, but
right.
I just want to make sure I understand your point.
Right.
The point being that what he says, right, the rich should be able to, the rich have more votes.
That's right. And that's proper.
That's happening.
Not
first
only
of all.
is that's what's happening, but that is the logical conclusion of a set of ideas that have been put into operation in the 1500s.
Right. So, in other words, not only is it what's happening, which we all sort of, unfortunately, we all sort of know in the back of our head, like the rich
despite
are powerful,
the laughter, despite the
and we all sort of know that
this is the tension, right? He's telling you the truth, despite the fact that you are in a position to bear it.
Yeah, and you're a couple of but. But what you're also suggesting is it's not an accident.
No.
It's not something that he has done specifically or a band of rich people have gotten together and said, okay, this is what we're going to do.
No.
The idea being that this is always the way it's been.
Absolutely. And in fact, let me put it bluntly. Contrary to the mythos of what most people think about the origins and the purposes of modern liberal egalitarian democratic politics, the purpose of politics was designed and constructed and put into place for the sole purpose of the naturally aristocratic, the naturally talented, the naturally superior to find safe venues for their natural inequalities, their natural talents to flourish and thrive and so they can profit. Politics becomes the arena in which and the purpose for which natural aristocracy, natural forms of inequality, of genius, of athletic capacity, of beauty, of a swiftness of mind, politics becomes the space in which those things are allowed to flourish.
So
politics becomes the space in which inequality is celebrated and allowed to thrive. It's exactly contrary to what most people actually believe.
Right. So what we're saying here at the issue is, and I'm just going to paraphrase, politics, the Constitution, the sort of any of the documents, the Magna Carta, all these documents leading up to where we are today are designed specifically so that
inequality can thrive.
So right. So that genius, so that athletic ability, so that, you know, in the modern sense, good looks can thrive. And I'm going to use a weird term, legally.
Yeah.
What we're doing is we're looking at this inequality and we allow for the inequality so that these people have a protected space to heighten this inequality?
To perfect
this inequality.
And that's right. And
so that people, you know, the sort of masses, if you will.
Yep, what Machiavelli called the vulgar.
The vulgar, the 99%.
Yep.
You know, however you want to decide it. But average everyday people are meant to stay average everyday people.
Oh, absolutely.
And allow for this 1% to thrive.
Yep.
In the system that we've created for them. And when I say we, I mean the Founding Fathers. I mean all the political thinkers to this time have said, hey, we need to, we've created this space so that the genius among us, so that the Bill
ambitious,
Gates.
The talented, the ambitious, the brilliant. Yeah. Whatever natural capacity that you have as a potential of power that you can transfer into wealth, into value, right? It might be some natural inequality of genius. It might be some natural inequality of beauty or athletic ability.
So if you're Nate Silver,
right,
you can translate your ability with numbers into moving yourself into the 1%. If you're Michael Jordan and you're better than anybody else at basketball, you then transcend yourself into the 1%.
Right.
Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie, your beauty, your talent
is a source of power.
It's a source of power, moves you into the 1%.
Right, into wealth.
And the system is rigged.
The system is not rigged. The system is created.
The system is created.
Right. To allow that to flourish.
Interesting.
The socioeconomic and political system we now live was not designed to promote equality and to safeguard the well-being of average people. It was actually created to provide a space in which naturally existing forms of inequality can flourish and be translated into the capacity to acquire, to pursue and acquire more wealth and more capacity to consume. It's exactly the opposite of what you are taught in school.
Now, the 1% know this.
Absolutely.
The 1% understand,
of course,
that this is a game.
Of course.
That this, the system is rigged. Not rigged.
See, again.
I know.
The mythos is so deeply embedded in your consciousness.
Right.
That somehow what Perkins is talking about is a rigging of the system.
Right.
It's some criminal reappropriation of the otherwise noble and free and democratic space.
Right.
Or it's been rigged. Or there's a few bad apples. Or these guys were just greedy. Again, that view is still the dominant view about what the hell happened in 2008.
Right.
Right. With the collapse of the housing market and credit swap differentials and derivatives. And some of this is our fault, because as you had said correctly earlier, many people, this is sort of what Nietzsche said about most people's awareness that God is dead, right? Most people are nihilists, Nietzsche said, because they have this sense that God or the source of their highest values is dead, that their highest values no longer perform the purpose that their values are supposed to perform for them. But Nietzsche said they're nihilists because while they know that somewhere in their heart, they don't possess the emotional courage and the clarity to own it and live in a world in the death of God.
Right.
And what you had said earlier about this idea that some people kind of know this is very similar. Many people know this. This is what's so bizarre about this. Perkins can come on a national television show. He can say, look, you shouldn't get to vote unless you pay taxes. And if I pay $1 million in taxes, I should get 1 million votes. And people are outraged and they laugh. But there's some sort of deep, profound, brooding dissonance in their heart because they know he's right. But they're unprepared to confront it because they're unprepared for what that means. If they actually have to bear witness to that, it's going to be so staggering to them. It's going to be so disillusioning of their value, of their purpose, of their integrity, of who the hell they think they are, that they're not prepared for it.
Okay. Quickly,
yep.
Before we go to break, we got a couple of minutes.
Right.
Let's back this up for a second.
Yeah, and do a quick, this is so important.
We ran down the road. Let's back this up and quickly.
Yeah, that's my fault. No.
I'm glad we were able to get out our thesis to make sure everybody can hear it. And what I want to talk about is this Fine's voice first with Machiavelli.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then is perfected by by Hobbes and Locke.
Absolutely.
So start briefly. And when I say briefly, I mean briefly.
Yeah.
Where does this start? Where does this go? Who perfects it?
Machiavelli changes the world in 1527 with the publication of The Prince. We've talked about this text before.
Many times.
The fundamental theme about The Prince is this. Aristocratic, unique, rare, naturally superior men and women. Their sole purpose in life is the acquisition and the maintenance of power for their glory.
Right.
Powerful men and women open and create the political space through exercises of power for their own glory and their own sort of vanity. The key here is that these people are, on Machiavelli's view, unique. These people are rare. These are the handful of people who show up on the world historical stage and create politics, open the political space, make the tough mm-hmm. decisions, build empires. But at the end of the day, these are aristocratic people.
Right.
Everybody else Machiavelli calls the vulgar. And Machiavelli calls people the vulgar because most people, Machiavelli said, are really interested in a little bit of comfort. They're really interested in some small desires, and they forget quickly. So Machiavelli said, look, all you have to do is appease these people in some way. All you got to do is appear one way. You got to appear kind. You got to appear generous. Give them some security. Create a space in which they can pursue their small and petty dreams. And if you do that, they'll be happy. Sure. That's what Machiavelli meant by the vulgar. But the world is made for the powerful. It's made for the naturally talented, the naturally superior. The world isn't made for the vulgar. The vulgar happen to live in those people's world.
Right.
Now, the challenge of modernity is precisely this. Machiavelli, Hobbes, and Locke all understand that these naturally aristocratic individuals have to make some deal with the vulgar. Right. And this is Hobbes's great contribution. Hobbes says, look, I too understand, Hobbes says, that the world is populated with these very powerful, naturally superior people of mind, of beauty, of genius, of athletic capacity, right? But the problem is, Hobbes says, is that prior to the existence of legal and political institutions, which you know, provide security for everybody, the vulgar are very capable of destroying the aristocratic.
Right.
Right. So according to Hobbes, and the way Hobbes deepens and radicalizes Machiavelli's insight, this, and by the way, this becomes the real source of the origin of equality in the modern world.
Right.
It's the idea of equality, the origin of the idea of equality doesn't emerge out of this idea that everybody possesses this inherent moral equality and dignity and should be respected. That's a mythos. Right. The origin of equality comes from this idea. Everybody is equally vulnerable to a violent death.
Right.
So equality is revealed through the equal vulnerability to death. Now, these aristocrats understand that. And here's the problem. In this sort of state of nature, in this sort of natural condition that you and I exist in prior to the construction of legal and political institutions, right? It doesn't matter how many talents you have. It doesn't matter how naturally superior or naturally aristocratic you are. None of those abilities, none of those talents will ever provide you the capacity to protect yourself on your own from the vulgar.
So, in other words, the vulgar could revolt no matter how fast you are.
No matter how brilliant.
No matter how, the vulgar will catch you. It's not even revolution.
It's just violence. It's just brute violence. And it's not just that the vulgar will catch you. You can't actually use your talents in a way that will be beneficial and profitable to you. Because if you're Bill Gates, you're not going to build a Microsoft in the absence of legal and political institutions of safety.
You're just going to survive.
You're just going to survive. So it doesn't matter if you're Kobe Bryant or Bill Gates or Brad Pitt. All of these natural talents, these natural
superiors, have nowhere to show themselves.
They mean nothing.
Right.
They only become possible in the political space.
Right.
And that's what these people know. This is the key. That's what they know. They know that their talents have no capacity to find expression in the absence of politics. And more importantly, they understand politics as a human construction. It's an invention. It's something they build. It's a space and an arena they build in which their natural superiority can flourish. That's the ironic origin of the social contract.
Right.
Locke said the same thing. I'm getting my history quickly. Locke came along after Hobbes and said, you know what? You're right. And in his ironical way, he said, you know what? God gave the world to the rational and the industrious. Right. So now the purpose of life is to go out, use your mind, use your labor, mix it with the land. And when you do that, you create property.
Mm-hmm.
Locke changes the world. This is the origin of the modern liberal capitalist idea of the acquisition of property ownership in the effing world.
Right.
And Locke says what powerful, talented people do is go out and put wealth into the world and acquire property.
Right.
And the more ambitious you are, the more talented you are, the more property you're going to own. And at the end of the day, you're going to need government to protect that damn property.
Now, is he saying that it can be anybody? That it's not just aristocrats? It's not just this? But everybody has an equal shot at this? Or is it only just that that sort of elite Machiavelli talks about.
Most people are vulgar.
Most people are the vulgar.
Most people are the vulgar. Most people, and by the way, it's no accident. It's absolutely no accident that another dominant idea that emerges in modern liberal philosophy is this idea that happiness isn't pleasure. So if you really want to seduce and arrest the vulgar, you just tell them that the purpose of their life, what people call happiness, is pleasure. And you get pleasure through consuming.
Here's where I got to rein you in, because
right.
This is a whole nother lecture.
Yeah, but they're connected.
I'm not saying they're
right?
not.
Because this is what makes the vulgar the vulgar. They're easily satisfied. And late modern post-industrial entertainment society is nothing but the easy satisfaction of vulgar wants.
The Kardashians,
of course.
Survivors.
It's a race to the bottom.
Allowing the vulgar to stay satisfied, to stay
absolutely.
Happy, to stay medicated, if you will,
absolutely.
So as to not rise up.
While the super rich construct and reconstruct
okay.
the social and political space through their wealth.
This is a great place to take a break
right.
because when we come back, we're going to talk about the super rich, how they're reconstructing it. And what we're doing to sort of pacify it, right? We're just being passive about letting them.
Yeah, we're voting on American Idol.
Right.
That's where our votes are.
Instead of voting in the last election.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
We'll be right back.
Okay, bye.
And we're back. Thanks, Nick. Thanks for coming back, people. So the vulgar have been pacified.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's where we are.
Mm-hmm.
It's
easy to do it.
Yeah, the rich, the powerful, the 1%.
It's easy to do it.
Have pacified the vulgar. How do the vulgar get unpacified? How do you sort of move forward in this? With these realities coming to light, with the idea that the 1% control, it's not an accident that they control. They didn't rig a system. It's designed so that the 1% can flourish.
Absolutely.
And be protected in flourishing.
Absolutely.
Well, actually, you know what? My question is twofold. So I want to talk about how the vulgar respond to this.
Right.
But I want to talk about, too, why then reveal the curtain? Why then pull back the curtain and show this? Why then do you take down the system that you're trying to protect if you're the 1%, you know, no taxes, you know, this whole Tea Party movement, the Koch brothers kind of moving against the Tea Party. Would you not try to protect and insulate these apparatus as best you can?
Yeah, I think they do.
Okay.
First of all, and I think that we have discussed this in the past when we talked about the crisis. It's the same whether you're talking about the Occupy Wall Street movement or the Tea Party.
Right.
There is a total disconnect between their ability, between the ideas that they have in their head about what they think the political space is and ought to be, and their ability to put those in action.
Right. But let me stop you here because that's not what I'm talking about.
Okay.
What I'm talking about is literally Ted Cruz going, shut it down.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Break down this apparatus.
Yeah.
You know, not so many social programs. You know, you
right.
literally have
right.
a right wing of the party. And,
right.
and we'll call them a Tea Party. Not all feel the same way. I don't mean
right.
to generalize. But you have this faction of the Republican Party going, shut the government,
right.
shut it down. And they're funded by the Koch brothers, who are this 1%, who are these elite people. So what's their end game?
Yeah. First of all, I think it's theater.
Okay.
First of all.
Yeah.
And I think there is something to be gained strategically from people like Perkins or the Koch brothers to sort of perpetuate this myth, right?
So the idea is he comes out with it, everybody laughs at it, and it continues.
Sure. Of course. Well, to go back to your question about the Koch brothers, you know, I think that there is a clear interest in these extraordinarily wealthy and influential people at some level to perpetuate the myth that the vulgar really do have a vote, that the vulgar really can change the direction of government and policy. And again, this is what Perkins has done is astonishing.
Right.
Perkins has come out and said something that is fundamentally true.
Right.
And not just true, but expressive of the core logic of liberal political economics and philosophy at its most fundamental level. And the fact that people either find it outrageous or laugh at it is precisely the fact that because the vulgar believe in the fundamental truth of freedom and moral equality and this sort of democratic spirit of self-governance. I mean, they really believe it.
Right.
You know, that it's precisely their commitment to those ideas and the objective truth of those ideas that sort of hides and deepens the sort of power over them.
Right.
You
right,
know,
right.
And so, you know, your question about the Koch brothers is very good. I don't want to get too dark about this, but clearly it's the case that there is some incentive to perpetuate the system and to perpetuate the myth.
Right. Right. There is an end game involved. We just potentially don't know what it is or we're not going to speculate on it.
Who?
The Koch brothers. The idea that they're going to fund.
Oh, look, the end game is perpetuating the situation as it is.
Right.
There's no way in hell. There's no way in hell they would actually do what they publicly talk about doing.
Right.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely not.
Okay. So then let's talk about how the vulgar should respond.
Yeah.
Once you know you're the vulgar, and right. odds are if you listen to this podcast, you're one of the 99%.
Right.
And so you're the vulgar.
Yeah.
You're who Machiavelli is talking about.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How do you, or do you?
Yeah. Well, you see, that's the question, right? That I, at a very profound level, I hope this doesn't sound as pessimistic, right? But the very fact that Machiavelli described you and Hobbes later and Locke later described you in one way or another. Hobbes didn't necessarily use the same language and Locke didn't necessarily use the same language, but the meaning and the implication is the same.
Right.
And the very fact that Machiavelli could describe you as vulgar and ultimately be right about it says something.
Right.
Right. People, and this cuts to the very core of your question. It's a disturbing question.
Yes, it is.
People don't want to do anything about it.
Right.
Right. They are satisfied with their security and they are satisfied with their what they believe to be their small piece of the American middle class, the sort of the American dream. Now, forget what the statistics tell about that. Forget the fact that statistics tell you that the middle class is gone, that wages have been stagnant for 30 years, that the only jobs that have been created in the post-collapse have been part-time, low-end jobs.
Right, right.
Forget the fact that corporate CEOs are now using artificial intelligence and technology to get rid of what's left of the white-collar jobs. Forget all of that. The fact is that the vulgar don't recognize it. They're not interested in seeing it. They're not interested in bearing witness to it. And as long as the Perkins and the Koch brothers and the Goldman Sachs, as long as they can maintain minimum levels of growth in the GDP, 1-2%, you know, just enough where people, consumer confidence remains fairly high, they continue to purchase, maybe they leverage and debt finance. Again, another story I just saw today, consumer debt is now reaching pre-collapse levels. It's back. The whole game is back.
The whole game is back.
The whole game, that's my point, right? The whole game is back.
Right.
And the banks are more vulnerable from one point of view. They'll be saved by the government. Homeowners are more vulnerable to debt collapse. There's now $1 trillion in student loan debt.
Right.
The game's back. Right. And the fact that the game is back, the fact that the vulgar, either they're not interested, they don't care, reveals something very potentially devastating about Machiavelli's observation that this is who they are.
Right.
That this is what they want.
Right.
Right. So that your question, well, how do they respond? How do they escape? It's from a certain point of view, it's not the right question.
There's no answer to that question because nobody wants to escape.
They don't want to escape.
They want the vulgar will stay the vulgar.
Yes. They're easily satisfied. They're easily manipulated. They're easily seduced. And as long as you sort of maintain, you know, sort of economic growth at basic levels, as long as consumer purchasing capacity remains, you know, growing at 1-2%, then and as long as the television, you know, continues to to stream live
American
content.
Idol
American
and the Super Idol, Bowl and
right. Absolutely. Right, this right. this and again, I forgive me for sounding like this, but this isn't an accident.
Right.
This is the end result of the system that was consciously put in place.
Right.
Right. And this is what Hobbes meant. What happiness is the constant unending pursuit of one desire after another that ceases only in death. And the typical way that that happiness is understood is a type of biological and biophysiological sensation, literally what we call sensation.
Right.
And we've just about perfected the model. And now the goal for corporations, for the 1%, even for governments now, and we've been talking about this
right.
for several episodes. Now the goal is just managing what Foucault would call governance, managing that on that process.
Right.
And not just domestically, but on a global level.
Right. Well, you can't just do it domestically. The borders are gone
right.
now. As we talked about in the crisis, it's sort of
right.
trans, hyper, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
All of the borders are gone.
Yes.
Transmodern, as we call
absolutely.
It. Absolutely. That those borders are gone. And so you do have to play on a worldwide stage now. It's not as simple as just playing to the local. So let's wrap this up.
Yep.
We started with Perkins.
Yep.
He pulls the veil.
Yeah.
He shows this. We have this reaction, or at least...
Yeah, this laughter and this outrage.
Outrage.
Yep.
What's the next step? Or are we really saying that there is no next
step?
This
is it.
This is what we encounter. This is who we are.
This is who we are, and it can't be fixed.
And it just is.
It is. And it will just remain to be managed.
Right. It has been this way
yep.
since... Before Machiavelli, because Machiavelli discovers, I put in air quotes, but, you know, sort of reveals this, because it exists long before Machiavelli. He just sort of puts a name to it.
Yeah, well, we have to be careful there, because Machiavelli changes the definition of human nature.
Okay.
Right? And now maybe what you are saying is, well, perhaps what Machiavelli does is provide a more accurate definition.
Right.
Than what the classical Greeks and the New Testament Christian theorists had thought about. And maybe that's the way you want to put it, right? But this is it. This is not an accident. This is not a betrayal of the nobility.
And over the last 500 years or so, as we've sort of seen this, it hasn't changed.
No.
It's just been perfected.
Right.
And other political philosophers.
Philosophers?
Thank you. Political philosophers along the way have just sort of fine-tuned it.
Yeah,
I've just sort of picked up another piece of it.
Right.
You know, sort of taken his work, and as time changes, and
well, certainly Hobbes and Locke and the founding fathers, absolutely.
Just sort of perpetuate it.
Of course,
the founding fathers disguise it a little better.
Yeah.
But it continues.
Well, the founding fathers understand perfectly well they need the vulgar.
They need the vulgar.
Right. And
they need the vulgar to be pacified.
Yeah, of course.
They need the vulgar to be obedient. They need the vulgar to stay in line. They need the vulgar not to revolt.
Absolutely. Be the vulgar.
To be the vulgar. To be what Machiavelli divine.
Absolutely.
All right. Last word on this.
Yeah. So Perkins told you the truth.
Okay.
Perkins told you the truth. The rich have a million votes.
Right.
And you have one.
I just want to put a plug in for an old DSU podcast we did, Life is Art.
Right.
Because I feel like if you want to sort of move on from this, like if you've listened to this and gone, oh, boy.
Boy, where do I go?
Where do I go? Go listen to the Life is Art podcast. Because that's really what's left. Now, I don't want to say what's left for the vulgar, but it's a way for you to express yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. If you are interested in transcending this situation...
Machiavelli's definition of the vulgar.
Of what life is.
Right.
Right. And what happiness is and success. And therefore, you know, if you feel like that does not serve you well, that you understand that Perkins is telling you the truth and you're frustrated, then you do have options. Right. You can resist what they are selling you.
Right.
That's possible. And you can begin the process of treating your own consciousness and your own life, as corny as it sounds, literally as a work of art.
Right.
And you can start carving out spaces in your private life and in your creative activities and your professional life. I mean, you can do what we're doing. You can create a podcast.
Sure.
Right? You can use technology. You can use information in creative ways. that are deeply satisfying, that are sort of productive of a new sense of happiness, mm-hmm. and a new sense of identity and purpose.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And again, we spent a whole hour on it, on the Life is Art podcast. So
absolutely.
Check it out. It's on. It's available on iTunes. Also available on the website, urdsu.com. Nick, as always.
All right, Walker.
Been a pleasure.
Great to see you again. Well, and hello, everybody, and take care.
We'll see you on the next one.
Bye.
Thanks.